You know how sometimes you see a field that looks empty, but could be used for something great? Well, today we're looking at something kind of similar, but with the airwaves we use for like our phones and internet.
Spectrum.
Exactly. We're diving into some draft regulations from South Africa that basically aim to make much better use of those airwaves.
Right. Think of it almost like unlocking unused potential in the radio frequency spectrum. It's definitely a hot topic.
So what's the source we're looking at?
We've got the draft regulations on dynamic spectrum access. These were published by the South African government back on March 28th, 2025.
Okay.
And our mission today, really, is to take this, well, that's a pretty dense document, let's be honest, and pull out the key bits, make it clear why it matters, how it might change things.
Dynamic spectrum access, DSA. Okay, it sounds like a fix for a problem I wasn't maybe fully aware of. What's the basic idea?
Well, at its heart, DSA is all about efficiency. It's a mechanism, a way to let secondary users tap into radio frequencies when the main licensed users aren't actually using them at that moment or in that place.
Ah, like borrowing the empty field.
Exactly. And these draft regulations from ICASA, that's the Independent Communications Authority of South Africa,
Right, ICASA.
they're trying to set up a system to manage this sharing properly. It builds on some earlier work they did, position papers and findings documents. It's quite a shift from the old way of just carving up spectrum and giving exclusive rights.
Okay, so ICASA is driving this, but why now? What's the big push?
There are a few key reasons. A big one is trying to expand broadband access, especially getting better internet to areas that are, underserved right now.
Makes sense. Connectivity gaps.
Definitely. Another goal is to lower the hurdles for smaller telecom companies to get into the market. More players could mean more competition, maybe better services, better prices.
Interesting. Disrupting the big guys a bit.
Potentially, yes. And it's also about fostering innovation. Opening up spectrum could let new wireless technologies emerge, and just fundamentally making smarter use of a scarce resource. Spectrum isn't infinite, right?
True.
But they also have to make absolutely sure that the existing users, the primary ones, don't get messed up by interference. That's critical.
Okay, more access, more players, innovation. Sounds good. But I bet, like with any new rules, there's a whole load of new jargon.
Oh, absolutely. You're right. Definitions are important here.
What are some key ones we need to get our heads around?
Okay, well, first off, they talk about the innovation spectrum.
Innovation spectrum.
Because this refers to two specific chunks, two frequency ranges. One is 3,800 megahertz up to 4,200 megahertz. And the other is 500, 925 megahertz to 600, 425 megahertz. Think of these as sort of designated zones for this new dynamic access.
Got it. Zones for innovation.
Pretty much. Then you have innovation spectrum devices, IZs for short. These are the actual devices, the gadgets that will operate in these innovation spectrum bands. And the key thing is they can do this without needing their own exclusive license, but only if they follow a specific rule.
Okay, license light, sort of.
Kind of, yeah. And there are two main types they define, ISCPE Cat 1 and ISCPE Cat 2.
Cat 1 and Cat 2, what's the difference there? Sounds a bit technical.
It is a bit, but the main difference is about where they operate and how they get their instructions. So ISCPE Cat 1, these are client devices. They need to have geolocation capability, like GPS.
So they know where they are.
Exactly. They're allowed to operate in that lower frequency band, 3,800, 4,200 millihertz, as long as they're connected to and controlled by what's called a master device.
Okay, a master device controlling the Cat 1s. What about Cat 2?
ISCPE Cat 2 devices also need geolocation, but these are designed to be permanently fixed, like installed on a building.
Ah, not mobile.
Right. And they operate in the higher frequency band, 5,925, 6,425 millihertz. The really crucial difference for Cat 2 is they can get specific operating instructions called operational parameters, or OPs, directly from a central system. This system is called the Unified Spectrum Switch, or USS.
Unified Spectrum Switch, USS. Okay, that sounds important. Like the air traffic controller for the spectrum.
That's a great analogy. Yeah, the USS is basically the brain managing the whole thing.
And you mentioned master and client devices. How does that relationship work?
Think of the master device as the local manager. It oversees the client devices connected to it within its little network.
Okay.
These master ISDs, they act as a go-between. They handle the requests for spectrum access from their associated clients and talk to the central USS. They also need capabilities to operate in both innovation spectrum bands themselves within limits.
Got it. And who's running these networks?
That would be the network operator. It's just the term for a company that holds an electronic communications network service license. Standard stuff. And one last really key concept. Secondary user, this is vital. A secondary user is allowed to use a band, but only on the condition that they don't cause harmful interference to the primary service. And they also can't claim protection from the primary service. They have to yield.
Okay, so they're guests, essentially. Important guests, maybe, but guests.
Pretty much, yeah. They need to tread lightly.
All right, so these ISDs are the workhorses here. Let's dig into them a bit more. Cat 1 first.
Sure. So ISCPE Cat 1, operating in that 3800, 4200 megahertz range, their geolocation is key because the USS, via the master device, needs to know where they are to figure out if it's safe for them to transmit.
Right, avoiding clashes.
Exactly. They're basically hopping onto unused spectrum under the guidance of their master device. Now, ICBE Cat 2, the fixed ones in the higher 5925, 6425 megahertz band, they also need that location data.
Right.
But their ability to directly get those operational parameters, the OPs, from the USS is central to how they work. It gives them more direct guidance.
And the master ISDs, you said they bridge the gap.
Absolutely. They're more than just connection points. They're the interface to the USS for their client devices, managing the requests. Plus, they have their own operating rules and power limits within those innovation spectrum bands. A pretty critical role.
So practically speaking, how does a network operator with all these devices actually get permission to use this spectrum? What are the steps?
Okay, so first, the regulations specify the channel sizes they can use. For the lower band, ISFR1 they call it, it's chunks of 10, 20, 30, or 40 megahertz.
Okay.
For the higher band, ISFR2, it's wider channels, 20, 40, 80, or even 160 megahertz.
Bigger pipes, potentially?
Right. Now, for an operator to use any of this, they first need the right licenses or exemptions from ICASA. That's step one.
Standard regulatory stuff.
Yes. And any ISD they plan to deploy must be type approved or authorized by ICASA. They can't just use any old kit.
Quality control.
Exactly. And this is fundamental. All their equipment in the innovation spectrum must operate on a secondary basis. No causing harmful interference to the incumbents. That's paramount.
And access is only through?
The USS, the Unified Spectrum Switch. It's the single gateway for secondary users into this innovation spectrum.
Okay, the USS keeps popping up. It really is the gatekeeper. How does an operator get its attention? How do they register?
They have to formally apply, and they do that through a dedicated USS portal.
Online application.
Seems so.
Yeah.
And requires quite a bit of detail. All the company info, contacts, copies of their existing licenses, naturally.
Sure.
But also technical details of every ISD they plan to use, the exact geographical areas they want to cover.
Mapping it out.
Precisely. And crucially, proof that they've paid the USS access fees.
Ah, there's a cost.
There is. Once ICASA gets all this, they verify it. If it checks out, they issue a spectrum availability certificate, which is only valid for 7 working days, interestingly.
Short window.
Yeah, suggests they need to move quickly.
Oh.
Then, the USS platform gets enabled for them for the lower band once payment is confirmed, and for the higher band once they show they're meeting all the rules.
Okay, so the operator gets the nod, but what about the individual devices out in the field? How do they talk to the USS and get permission to transmit?
Right, so all that communication back and forth between the USS and the ISDs, or related gear, it has to follow a specific protocol. It's called the Communication Protocol for Accessing the Unified Spectrum Switch, or CPAUS. They need to use the latest version.
A standard language.
Exactly. And when a master device or a fixed Cat 2 device or maybe a database proxy needs those operational parameters, the OPs, from the USS.
The instruction.
Yes. They have to send specific info. Unique IDs for the device, its precise geolocation, again, super important, and various technical parameters about how it wants to operate.
What kind of power, what frequency, that sort of thing.
Yeah, things like antenna height, gain, requested bandwidth. There's also a defined process for when they first register with the USS and what happens when their OPs expire. They can't just keep operating. They need fresh permission.
Keeps it dynamic, I guess.
That's the idea. Constant check-ins.
So what exactly is in these operational parameters that the USS sends back? What are the specific instructions?
The OPs are the detailed marching orders for each channel the device might use. They'll specify the exact transmit and receive frequencies it's allowed.
Okay.
The maximum permitted transmit power, usually measured as EIRP equivalent isotropically radiated power.
Power limits, right.
Very important. Also, the time window these parameters are valid for. It might not be 247.
Ah, okay. Time limited access.
Potentially. And the precise geographical area where they apply and the total duration the spectrum can be used under those parameters. It's quite granular control.
Definitely sounds like fine-grained management. You mentioned power limits. They seem critical for avoiding interference. What are the actual limits set in these regulations?
They are quite specific, and they vary depending on the band and the deployment scenario. For ISFR1, that lower band.
3,800, 4,200 megahertz.
Right. In urban outdoor settings, if the antenna is over 20 meters above ground.
High up.
Yeah, the limit is 27 dBm per 20 megahertz of bandwidth. But in rural outdoor areas, with an antenna up to 30 meters, they allow more power. 47 dBm for 40 megahertz.
Okay, different rules for urban versus rural. Makes sense.
And for indoor use, antenna up to 10 meters is 28 dBm, but measured as TRP, total radiated power, which accounts for the antenna itself.
Different measurement. Got it. What about the higher band, ISFR2?
For ISFR2, 5925, 6425 megahertz, it's a bit simpler. Urban outdoor, antenna up to 20 meters is 30 dBm. Rural outdoor, antenna up to 30 meters is 36 dBm.
Okay.
And there's an interesting point for indoor ISDs in this higher band. They allow an extra 14 dB to account for signal loss through building walls.
Ah, the building penetration loss.
Exactly. Across the board, there's a general rule. ISDs must reduce their power if needed, either to stay within these absolute limits or, critically, to avoid causing interference, even if they are technically below the limit.
So the limits are ceilings, not targets. Avoiding interference is the priority.
That's the message, yes.
What other protections are built in? How do they make sure these secondary users don't step on the toes of the primary incumbent users?
A few key things. First, the incumbents, the primary users who need protection, they have to register their existing systems with ICASA.
So ICASA knows who's already there and needs protecting.
Precisely. And when they register, they need to provide a lot of technical detail. Facility info, contacts, what service they're providing, technology used, exact coordinates, antenna height, direction, power levels.
The works.
A detailed map of existing usage.
Yes. Then the ISDs themselves, they must be installed by professional installers. No DIY adjustments allowed.
Prevents tampering.
Right. And they explicitly state that ISDs cannot be altered or interfere with the technical characteristics of the incumbent systems.
Okay.
When the USS calculates those OPs for an ISD, its main job is to ensure the incumbents are protected. It uses specific technical criteria, often based on interference to noise ratios, in thresholds.
So it does the math to keep things separate. It has to. There are also strict limits on out-of-block emissions, how much signal can spill outside the assigned channel.
Like staying within the lines.
Exactly. The USS coordinates operations constantly to minimize interference potential. There are also guard bands, unused frequencies between the innovation spectrum and adjacent bands, and power limits in those adjacent bands too, to protect services operating just above 4,200 megahertz or below 3,800 megahertz.
Buffer zones.
Yeah. And finally, those master devices and the fixed Cat 2 ISDs need really accurate geolocation. The accuracy requirements are specified because knowing precisely where they are is fundamental to the interference calculations.
Makes sense. Location, location, location.
In this context, absolutely.
Okay, so lots of preventative measures. But, you know, stuff happens. What if interference does occur despite all this? Is there a protocol?
Yes. There's a clear process laid out for dealing with interference incidents.
How does it work?
If an incumbent user, the primary one, experiences harmful interference they believe is caused by an ISD, they report it directly to ICASA.
Okay, report to the regulator.
Right. ICASA can then instruct the USS, the central controller, to investigate. And if necessary, the USS can be told to suspend the spectrum assignments for ISDs in the affected area while they figure it out.
Pause operations.
Exactly. And here's a critical part. Any ISD identified as causing harmful interference must cease operating immediately. The rule says within 60 seconds of getting the instruction from the USS.
Wow, 60 seconds? That's fast.
Yeah, it shows they're serious about protecting the incumbents. It's a rapid shutdown mechanism if things go wrong.
Okay, a kill switch essentially controlled by the USS on ICASA's orders.
That's a good way to put it.
Now, earlier you mentioned USS access fees. Let's talk money. What are the costs involved for network operators using this innovation spectrum?
Okay, so yes, network operators do have to pay license fees to ICASA for using the innovation spectrum.
Right.
The regulations specify that for operating ISDs in that lower band, ISFR1, 3800, 4200 megahertz, the standard requirements for getting spectrum licenses still apply, so likely fees consistent with other licensed bands.
So business as usual for fees in that band.
It seems so. However, for operating ISDs in the higher band, ISFR2, 5925, 6425 megahertz, it's stated to be license exempt.
Oh, interesting. No fees for the higher band.
Well, license exempt doesn't necessarily mean zero cost. There might still be the USS access fees, for instance. but it means they don't need a specific spectrum license for that band, aligning with how ICASA already regulates that frequency range for other uses, like Wi-Fi 6E.
Ah, okay, so potentially lower barrier to entry for using that higher frequency range, cost-wise.
Potentially, yes.
And what if someone just ignores the rules,
yeah,
uses the spectrum without authorization, causes interference, refuses to shut down? Penalties.
Oh, yes, there are definitely penalties. The regulations state clearly that contravening Regulation 4, that's the one about unauthorized use and causing harmful interference, constitutes an offense.
An offense under the law.
Yes. And if found guilty, the penalties can be quite severe. Potentially imprisonment for up to 6 months, or a fine up to 1 million rand, or even both.
Okay, so they have teeth. 1 million rand is not insignificant.
Not at all. It sends a clear message about compliance.
Now, I remember you mentioning an Appendix A earlier, something about simulations. What was that about? Did they test this stuff out?
They did. Appendix A summarizes quite a bit of technical analysis and simulation work that ICASA undertook.
What were they simulating?
They were modeling the coexistence between existing services, particularly fixed satellite service downlinks, often in C-band, and terrestrial fixed service links.
Like microwave links.
Exactly. Coexistence between those incumbents and potential new broadband wireless access, or BWA, systems operating in these innovation spectrum bands. Both the 3800, 4200 megahertz and the 5920/7, 6425 millihertz ranges.
Trying to see if they could all play nicely together in the sandbox.
Pretty much. They wanted to quantify the interference risks.
What did they find?
Some interesting geographical insights first. They found most of the C-band satellite downlinks are actually concentrated around Johannesburg.
Makes sense, major hub.
And similarly, most of the fixed service receivers in that upper band are located mainly in Gauteng province.
Okay, so the potential conflict zones are somewhat localized.
To an extent, yes. The simulations themselves assess the interference potential under various scenarios: urban clutter, rural environments, different ISD power levels, different antenna heights.
Trying to cover different real-world situations.
Right. And a key finding, really quite important, was that using detailed terrain and environmental clutter data.
Like buildings, hills.
Exactly. Using that detailed data allows for much more precise interference modeling compared to using generic, simplified models.
And the benefit of that is?
It means you can potentially identify more actual spectrum sharing opportunities. The detailed models might show that interference isn't actually a problem in many specific locations, where a simpler model might just say no go. It potentially unlocks more usable spectrum.
More accuracy means less unnecessary restriction.
That's the idea. The study also specifically looked at the required protection ratios, those IN levels, for the satellite receivers to make sure they weren't impacted.
So these simulations weren't just theoretical, they directly informed these draft rules.
Absolutely. The results fed directly into developing the technical parameters, the power limits, the coordination requirements like the USS role, all designed to facilitate this coexistence and keep interference manageable. It shows a data-driven approach.
It's good to see that level of technical homework behind the regulations.
Definitely adds credibility.
Okay, so wrapping this all up, quite a detailed look at these draft rules. What's the big picture takeaway for our listeners from this deep dive?
I think the main takeaway is that this represents a really significant and quite sophisticated effort by South Africa to modernize its spectrum management.
Moving beyond just static licenses.
Exactly. They're creating a framework for dynamic sharing, which, if it works as planned, could genuinely boost broadband deployment, spur innovation, and maybe even shake up the market a bit by lowering barriers for new entrants.
But the key is making it work.
Absolutely. The success really hinges on the effective implementation and operation of that unified spectrum switch. The USS is the linchpin. It needs to be robust, reliable, and fair in how it coordinates access and protects those primary users.
That central control is both the power and maybe the challenge, right?
It is. It allows for efficient coordination, but also means that system needs to perform flawlessly. It's a move towards much more active real-time spectrum management.
So for anyone actually working in telecoms in South Africa or maybe developing wireless tech or even just curious about how we connect,
they should probably take a look at the full document. These draft regulations give a real glimpse into the future direction.
And where can they find it again?
It's the Government Gazette number 52415 for March 28th, 2025, available from the Government Printing Works in Pretoria.
Good to know. This whole push for dynamic access, it really highlights that tension, doesn't it, between the exploding demand for wireless everything and the fact that spectrum is, well, finite.
It really does. We have to get smarter about how we use it. DSA is one approach.
Which definitely leaves you wondering, considering this relentless drive for connectivity and the limited spectrum we have, What other really creative, maybe even radical ways to manage spectrum might we see coming down the pike in the future?
That is the big question, isn't it? Definitely something to keep an eye on.
Food for thought. Until our next deep dive, thanks for listening.